morning. We have Rosh Hashanah coming. It's very funny. I was actually in the synagogue, not this past Shabbos, but the week before. And the rabbi was speaking, and he mentioned, now as we come into the home stretch, towards Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and I'm thinking that's an inappropriate use of the word homestretch. The homestretch is, you know, the end, the straightaway, when you're getting to the end of the race. But the truth of the matter is that for rabbis, we're in the homestretch in the sense that we've been preparing for this already for ages, and it feels like it's already here. I've been thinking about Rosh Hashanah for a month, so I feel like in some sense it's a homestretch, I suppose. I want to make sure to welcome those who have not been here before, and I hope you'll enjoy. For those who have not been here, I send out recordings of the class, audio recordings afterwards, so if you miss a week, you'll still be able to catch it that way. If you did not get the email that I sent a couple of days ago welcoming people, that means you were not on the list at that point. So please make sure that I have your email address. If, as the list goes around, you don't see your email address on the sheet, please make sure to write it in, unless you registered online in the last day or two, in which case it would have been after I made up the list. Okay, so the goal for these 2 weeks is to learn about a couple of customs that we have, why we do what we do, and to gain inspiration as we prepare for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. As I titled the class, Bobbing for Inspiration. My original title for the class, I think, was something like Apples and Honey and Water. And I was talking to somebody, and he said, you need something snazzier. It's got to be a better title than that. So I went with Bobbing for Inspiration. I hope that works. But actually, once I did that, I said, you know, there is this practice of bobbing for apples, which I trust you've all seen, engaged in at some point, and it's kind of a strange practice, the bobbing for apples thing, which, you know, when I was a kid growing up, you kind of associated it with either autumn in general or potentially people's, you know, Halloween things for those who are Halloween observers. But when you start to think about the practice, it's a very strange, not to mention unsanitary practice. You know, where in the world did that come from? Do you know where bobbing for apples comes from? So it's actually a Celtic practice. A Celtic practice. Or Celtics for basketball fans. If you take a look on source number one on the sheet, for a book called Curiosities of Superstition by W.H. Davenport Adams. It was on Halloween, or All Hallows' Eve, the evening of the 31st of October, that superstition ran riot in Celtic society. That's what he's talking about. Because on that particular evening, the supernatural influences of the other world were supposed to be specially prevalent, and the power of divination was likewise believed to be at its height. Apples are a relic of the old Celtic fairy lore. They are thrown into a tub of water, and you endeavor to catch one in your mouth as they bob round and round in provoking fashion. When you have caught one, you peel it carefully and pass the long strip of peel thrice, sunwise, around your head. I don't know if sunwise means east to west or clockwise. I don't know exactly what sunwise means in this context. But you peel it carefully, so you have a long apple peel. You pass it around your head, after which you throw it over your shoulder, and it falls to the ground in the shape of the initial letter of your true love's name. I don't know if this is prescribed for married people or singles. This is an interesting risk that you take when you engage in this activity. Of course, it does sound a little bit like, only a shade, but it's there, a particular Jewish practice that we're not going to get to, which is kaparot, right? Kaparot's practice. The kaparot's practice, or kaparot, of taking either a chicken or a plant or money and passing it around one's head. That's its own practice. For those who are interested in knowing more about that, on Sunday morning the 17th, I'll be giving a class on that at 10 a.m. at the Bayit in Thornhill. All women are welcome. That's a women's program. If you want to know more about it, I'll be glad to tell you about it afterwards. But I am planning on discussing that practice there. But I'm going to take a moment just to ask people if you have a cell phone that's ringing to please take care of it. But in terms of this practice that existed, this practice of, I don't know what, reading your future or reading information about yourself into an apple. So this is not connected to the apple and honey for Rosh Hashanah in any way. Not in terms of history, because our practice of having the apple for Rosh Hashanah is a practice that we will see is a couple of thousand years old. It is not linked to ours in terms of any of the laws that we do or the actual customs that we have. At the same time, what we are going to see are some texts which, at least for me, were eye-opening regarding the future-shaping aspects of our Rosh Hashanah customs. Not just future-telling, but future-shaping. Things that we do that are meant to affect the year to come. That's what we're talking about. And we're going to start with that classic favorite, the apples and honey, before moving on next week to talk about water and the relationship between water and Rosh Hashanah. So I'm kind of hoping people are familiar with the practice of dipping the apple in the honey. Are there any more source sheets? I printed more than 30 and we had 25 registrants. We have a couple over here. Okay, so here, I'll... I will also, when I send out the follow-up email from today, I'll send out the digital version. So those who signed up today will get that as well. Okay. But the practice of dipping the apple in the honey, about which we sang in preschool, dip the apple in the honey, right? You know this one. If you don't, I can't really remember all the words. But I know it starts dip the apple in the honey, so that's not bad. This practice is a practice on Rosh Hashanah night in particular, that everybody takes a piece of apple, they dip it in honey, or they put the honey on it, whatever you like, they'll make a blessing and they will eat it. And the question is, why? Why do we do this? What are we trying to accomplish? So if you take a look at source number 2, you find a line from the Talmud which doesn't mention apples, but does mention other foods. Abaye said, Abaye is a sage from the Talmud. He lived in roughly end of the 4th century, beginning of the 5th century. And he wrote, he said, since we say that signs are substantive, sign in the original Aramaic, simna, in Hebrew will be a siman. Signs are substantive, meaning they have an impact. One should accustom himself to eat the following foods at the start of the year. Gourds, fenugreek, leek, beets, and dates. Yeah, fenugreek. What is fenugreek? Sometimes you see it with an EC at the end. Instead of an EEK, you'll see it as fenugreek. I think that's, yes, correct. It is a spice. That's the way we usually use it. Right? For or against? Okay. So what in the world is this about? I know why you want apples, right? Apples are sweet, and we'll see other hints within apples. But what is it about these items? So the answer is, these items all carry hints in their names to positive messages. So, for example, to take one of them, leek is karti, kaf resh tuf yud, and karti means to cut off. And the idea is, it's actually a prayer of yikartu sonenu. Our enemies should be cut off. And this year, those who oppose us should be defeated. Beets in Hebrew. Anyone know beets are in Hebrew? Selek, good. And what is lesalek? To remove, right? Lesalek is to remove. Yistalaku sonenu, our enemies, those who would oppose us, should be gone. Yeah, we have all of these associations with names. Actually, it's funny. I had a friend who used to say that the practice in his yeshiva was that they would have on Rosh Hashanah, they would have on Rosh Hashanah, they would have a little bit of lettuce and greens, and then they would pass around raisins. And they would, yes, you know it. They would pass around raisins, and they would cut the raisin in half, and then they would pass around a piece of celery. Why? Let us have a raisin celery. You laugh, but think about it. What's the difference? It's English, but these names are, some of them are Aramaic. Karti is an Aramaic word.
Yeah, it's in every place.
Right? It's a pun. It's a play on words. That's what we're doing, and it's really no different. It's just that this is our language that we are used to as a vernacular, as opposed to the Aramaic of Karti. It's an added layer. Not all of these are about plays on words. We're going to see that right now. If you take a look at source number 3, we jump ahead in Jewish history to Rabbi Yaakov Baal HaTurim, author of a work of Jewish law called the Tur. And he says, in Germany, it is customary to start the Rosh Hashanah meal by dipping a sweet apple into honey, asking God to bless us with a sweet new year.
What, can you repeat the tefillah for...
For the apple? You're asking me to remember now. The Shetechadesh Aleinu Shana Tova Umetuka. We ask God to give us a new year that will be sweet, a good and sweet new year. Yes?
Can we go back to Fenugreek?
Fenugreek, yes. So Fenugreek, if I remember correctly, is Tiltan in Aramaic. So the question is then, what would be the association with Tiltan? Right, I have to look it up. I don't remember offhand what the Tiltan association is, so I'm going to have to send that out in the follow-up email. Tiltan, I think, was the name. Okay. Well, the cows don't have diabetes, so you know, it must be working. I'd have to go back and look it up. I don't remember offhand. So, the statement here is to dip a sweet apple into honey and to ask God for a sweet new year. In other words, the association is not about the name. The association is about the experience. You want to have a sweet food in order to be able to have a sweet year. Now, there are many sweet foods. So why is it that we pick on the apple in particular? Why apples? Please don't say Adam and Eve. Whatever you do, don't say Adam and Eve.
I thought one of the reasons it's a new crop.
It's a new crop.
Isn't that one of the things we're supposed to have something?
It's true that apples are a fall crop. That's true. But it's not necessarily about being new. I think what you're mixing into this is the practice of having a new fruit. On Rosh Hashanah?
No.
Right. There is a practice of having a new fruit on Rosh Hashanah, but that's actually a second night of Rosh Hashanah practice. That has to do with a tech... Don't worry about it if you're having it on the first night. But that's due to a technicality. You see, on Rosh Hashanah, for reasons that would take us the entire next hour to discuss, we observe 2 days of Rosh Hashanah. Even though theoretically it should just be one. It has to do with the problem of needing witnesses to see the new moon and come testify that they saw the new moon and having them arrive in Jerusalem in time to declare that day the beginning of the new year. The problem is that the new moon is, of course, invisible. Right? We all had our lesson in astrophysics when we had the eclipse last month, and now we understand the way this works, and you know that you can't see a new moon. That's the whole point. So it's not going to be visible for hours afterwards, and then only, of course, at night. And having them come to Jerusalem and get cross-examined and testify, the result could be that actually they don't show up until the afternoon of the first day, the only day, supposedly, of Rosh Hashanah. And therefore, we have these 2 days of Rosh Hashanah. It's a longer story than that. That's a very brief and imprecise explanation. But the point is, you have 2 days, which in Jewish law are viewed as being one long day. We treat the 2 days as being one long day in Jewish law. And that creates a problem. Because on the second night, when we make Kiddush, we also say a blessing of Shehecheyanu. Thank you, God, for bringing us to this day, which is only supposed to be done on the first day. So how are you doing it on the second day? Especially if it's treated as one long day. So it's really an extension of the first day. So that's why people have a new fruit, so that they can say, well, I'm having something new. Even if it's not a new holiday, it's still something new. That's the technical explanation behind the new fruit. It takes all the romance out of the idea. But that's the way it goes. Apples, though, are a different story. Apples, let me just state right at the outset, because I already made the reference, the Torah never ever says that Adam and Eve's fruit was an apple. Oh. Absolutely does not appear there. It shows up for the first time in Christian artwork. So there are four different explanations in the Midrash about what fruit it was. The one explanation is that it's the fig, and that's why they use the fig leaves to cover themselves. It's from the same tree. Another explanation is that it's an etrog, because the etrog is described in the Torah as a particularly beautiful fruit, and Chava sees the fruit, and Eve sees the fruit, and it's a beautiful fruit. Another explanation is that it's grape, because nothing, no fruit causes crying for humanity like the fruit of the grape. And then the fourth explanation is actually that it's wheat. Wheat. Not like you would think about a tree fruit at all, but actually that it's wheat. And the idea is because children start to manifest intelligence when they first start to eat grains. And the idea is that maybe that's a product of having consumed this fruit, which is from the tree of knowledge. The four different ideas. No one in Jewish literature had suggested apple. The apple association comes from either a verse in Shir HaShirim in Song of Songs, or from Latin. The verse in Shir HaShirim in Song of Songs, God tells the Jewish people, Tachat hatapuach orartich, beneath the apple tree I awakened you, Shama chiblatcha imecha. There, your mother, chiblatcha. Chiblatcha can be translated in two different ways. One, chavle leida, birth pangs. There your mother birthed you beneath the apple tree. And the sages understood that as a reference to the Jewish women giving birth to their babies in Egypt out in the fields, so that the Egyptians wouldn't be able to throw the baby boys into the river. But the church translated that verse differently. They took chiblatcha, like lechabel, to wound or to corrupt. So under the apple tree, there, chiblatcha imecha, your mother, Eve, corrupted you by eating from the fruit. So they took the idea that tachat hatapuach, beneath the apple tree, is a reference, thank you, to the, is a reference to that original fruit, or alternatively, I think it's St. Augustine who said it was an apple, because what's the term for apple in Latin?
Malum.
M-A-L-U-M. And when you want to say something is bad, your Latin prefix is mal. So clearly the sacred language of Latin understands that malum is bad. The apple is the bad fruit. So that's where it comes from, and the artist ran away with it, but we never said it was an apple. We have no association whatsoever of the apple as a bad fruit. You may not like apples, but you can't blame it on Adam and Eve. So going back to why we're using this then, what's with the apple? So one explanation is simply the taste. Linda suggests maybe it's the shape. What do you mean?
Well, because round is sort of a rounded ear.
A rounded ear? Could be. I haven't heard of it, but it's an interesting idea. The name tapuach itself comes from it being a round fruit. That's why oranges are tapuach zahav, right? Tapu is in modern Hebrew, and potato is tapuach adama, right? Apple of the ground. And associate that with French and palm and so forth. But I haven't heard of that as a Rosh Hashanah association. It's an interesting idea. But what you do have is, historically, going back to Talmudic times, the apple was considered medicinal. You talk about fenugreek and diabetes. The apple was considered to be medicinal. You find in Talmudic sources they would send apples to the ill. Apple a day keeps the doctor away. Anyone?
The
apple. Yeah, Dahlia.
Okay. We're looking at it from Ashkenazi point, Apple, Germany, blah, blah, blah. Did they also...
Oh, we're going to get to the Sephardim. We're not done. Okay. We're going to talk Sephardim also. Don't worry. The apple is also emblematic of our relationship with God, because in Shir HaShirim, in Song of Songs, there are actually numerous references to God's protection of us compared with the apple tree's shelter, and we are compared positively with the apple in Song of Songs. So you have associations in Tanakh as well. There are other explanations. There are mystical explanations as well. I gave you a reference in source number 5. Rabbi Yaakov Molin, also known as Maharil, a leading early Ashkenazi authority, gives you a reference to the blessing that Jacob received from his father Isaac. He smells when his son comes into the room and he says, "Ei reach b'ni k'reach sadeh, ha-sadeh." He says, the scent of my son is like the scent of the field, and after the part that I excerpted here, Asher Berachav Hashem, the field that God has blessed. And the sages commented on that and said, what does that mean? The smell is the smell of the field that God has blessed. They said that's the smell of the fragrant apple. And so there's an association with the apple orchard there. Side note, worth knowing. Historians, for a very long time, into the 20th century, believe that the word tapuach in Tanakh does not mean apple. Because they said there were no apple orchards in the Middle East. They hadn't found any apple orchards in the Middle East. They said it must mean something else. And they came up with all sorts of explanations. Quince. All sorts of different fruits that it could be. Something round, but not an apple. Until the 1950s. And the 1950s, archaeologists discovered that the Romans had destroyed fragrant apple orchards in Israel from that time. If you look online, there's an old encyclopedia called the Jewish Encyclopedia, not Encyclopedia Judaica, but Jewish Encyclopedia from the early 20th century, and it's available freely online. And if you look up apple there, it's old, it's pre this discovery, and therefore they tell you, yeah, there are no apples there, and there's no apple in Tanakh, and they just didn't know that the orchards actually had been there, and it was specifically the fragrant apple, interestingly, that was there. There are more explanations for this, for why we use the apple. But basically, the most fundamental point is the sweetness of the apple, and that's why it's specified here to use a sweet apple, and that's also why we use the honey. We are looking for a sweet experience. If you take a look at source number 6 from the same author as in number 5, Maharil, Rabbi Yaakov Molin, the reason we eat sweet foods is to declare that God will decree a good and sweet year for us. There are other customs of dipping things in honey. Some people dip challah in honey, right? Some people dip a sheep's head in honey. No? No one? Does it resonate? I was going to bring a prop, too. My vegetarian daughters would not be happy with me. Sephardim have other foods as well. I once spent the night of Rosh Hashanah with Persian friends of mine, and they had a whole bunch of other things. They had black-eyed peas. I don't think it was about you should have a black eye. I don't think that was it. But black-eyed peas were one of them. But a particular food is kubba. That I think Iraqi Jews have. Kubba, which in the Talmud is called tisni. You familiar? Kubba? Okay. It's an Iraqi food.
Semolina.
So it can have
wheat. Semolina wheat.
Right. Semolina or cracked wheat.
Yeah.
The bulgur.
The Yankee used to go to a very big restaurant in New York City called Kubba.
Really?
Oh.
Okay. Sorry?
Typically for Rosh Hashanah.
Yeah. For Rosh Hashanah specifically. Yeah. You don't have it? What did you have? What did you have for Rosh Hashanah?
We have the dates, we have the apple, we have the leaves, we have the celery.
The bees, yeah. But the idea of the kubba, or tisni as it's called in the Talmud, is also, it's a sweet and rich food. And it's supposed to give you a sense also of a good start to the year. There are all sorts of other ones. There's a practice I saw of having etrog, which strikes me as, yeah, why would you do that before, you know, right before Sukkot? Why are you eating the etrog? They're expensive enough. Like, why, you know. They all sorts of practices. There are carrots, and people cut up the carrots in different ways. The head of a fish, some have to be at the head.
Yeah.
So let's get beyond, though, having a sweet opening to the year, because there's so much more to discuss within this. I gave you the reference to the kubba, or tisni, as it's called, in sources 7 and 8. You can see there, going back to 9th century Babylon, the association in that source. But fundamentally, what is it that we're... Sorry?
Is the other name for kubba tisni?
Tisni, correct. So he can open up another restaurant and call it tisni. Mm-hmm. So the question is this something more than psychological? Is it simply, this is nice, we have to get ourselves into a good mood as we're going to start the year? Or is there something more meaningful actually involved? Are we trying to accomplish something by doing this? And once you ask that question, you have to then ask the next question, which is, if it is about some kind of influence, by eating this food, maybe I am able to predict what the year is going to be like, then you could actually run afoul of Jewish law, or so it appears. There is a prohibition in the Torah that says, lo tinachashu. Lo tinachashu, against what's called nichush. In modern Hebrew, what is linachesh? To guess. But they didn't view it as guesswork. Rather, linachesh for them was actually to predict the future. Lo tinachashu is a prohibition against fortune telling. Exactly. So, Onanu is to calculate omens based on times of the calendar and the like. That's exactly right. So, for example, if you remember the story of Joseph and how he, in the end, catches his brothers, after his brothers have already come down to Egypt, and Benjamin, the youngest, is there with them, and they buy food, and they're on their way home, and he tells his second in command there, do me a favor, take my goblet and put it into the sack of the youngest. Right? And then sends them on their way, and then summons them and says, wait a minute, wait, my goblet is missing, and I think you have it. And they find it, they find it in the sack of the youngest, of Binyamin, of Benjamin. And he says to them, how could you think you would get away with this? Halo yedatem, don't you know? Ki nachesh yinachesh ish asher kamoni. Don't you know someone like me can use supernatural powers to figure out what happened. Right? That's how he brings them back. Right? You know why he played that game. You know why he did that to them. It was not revenge. He wanted his brother, but there's more than that. He wants to put them in the same position they were in with him originally. Meaning, he is the son of Rachel versus the sons of Leah, and then you have the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, the maids as well, but primarily the sons of Leah. They view him as a threat. They think he is a bad guy who's out to hurt them and out to get things for himself, and they said, let's get rid of him. Right? Before he gets rid of us, let's get rid of him. That's their initial move. So Joseph says, let's see if they've learned their lesson. Once again, the son of Rachel, right, in this case Benjamin, looks like he is a bad guy out to get stuff for himself, and he is a threat to the rest of them. Let's see what they're going to do. Are they going to sell him down to Egypt also and say, well, let's leave him behind and go home, which is the offer on the table for them, right? And at that point, they show they've learned the lesson, because they say, we're not leaving without our brother. Right? And at that point, he says, okay, I'm Joseph, the game is over. Because he understands that they, given the opportunity to make the mistake again, they've showed that they learned their lesson. That's a brief, you know, note regarding that story, because I think it's a beautiful story. Once you understand what he's trying to accomplish, I think it's fascinating.
It's also they learn compassion for their father. They also say, you know, the way my father will survive the loss of it. So it's seeing your parent as a person. It's a
right.
Beautiful story.
Right.
And survive Benjamin's. He won't survive the loss of Benjamin.
Right. Although the way that Joseph uses it is really like it's the most sarcastic line I think in all of Tanakh. Right? Because they say to him, "You have to let our brother go, our poor father." Right? And Joseph says to them, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" He's not asking, you know, how's dad doing? He's saying, "Why weren't you worried about that for the last 20 years?" Right? And my father survived me. You know, why are you suddenly concerned now? So there's an edge in his comment. But yes, that is part of what they learned. But going back to this, source number 9. We are instructed not to engage in all sorts of magic and witchcraft. Do not eat upon of the blood. That's a whole other discussion. Do not read omens and do not calculate times. Reading omens, lo tenachashu, you're not supposed to try to predict the future based on experiences. So now my question is, what is this? What are we doing with this sweet fruit? Isn't it just like innocent, let's get into a good mood? Or is there something more here? And if there is something more here, why isn't it a problem of superstition? If we believe that we are actually impacting what's going to be, right? Go back to the wording in source number 2. Abaye said, signs are substantive, that they are meaningful. Then how are you allowed to do this?
Isn't a sign and an omen the same thing?
Yeah. So this seems to be problematic. Right? Why is it that a Jew is not supposed to engage in this sort of thing? Why is it that we're not supposed to be superstitious? Sorry? Avodah Zarah, idolatry. So that's one possibility. Take a look at source number 10. Rabbi Moses Maimonides. He says, all of these, meaning all of these different practices of omen reading and the like, are words of falsehood and deception which the early idolaters used to trick the nations to follow them. If someone can sell you on a superstition, they can cause you to believe that whatever it is that they are pitching is legitimate and draw you to follow whatever system of worship they want to promote. It is a gateway to idolatry.
Is
so this is a way to act out a request for a sweet year?
It's a
hungry prayer. So hold the thought. I'm going to come back to it. After I want to first go through this, what would be wrong with superstition, but then let's take a look at that as a possibility. Yeah.
So it's on the zodiac thing or whatever.
Astrology.
Astrology.
So astrology occupies a funny place in human history, in the sense that we think of astrology as superstition, right? I hope that's true that we think astrology as superstition. But historically, astrology was viewed as science. Meaning, they believed in the same way that we are aware, and have been since Newton, that that a body up in the distance can exert a force that is invisible on a body far away, right? The force of gravity. So there is an understanding in astrology that there are actually intelligences surrounding these entities and that they are able to exert forces on things that are far away from them. And they believe that this was a scientific thing. Like this, you know, there's a force of gravity, there's a force of whatever it is. So astrology, going back to Talmudic times, would not have been viewed as superstition. It would have been like, you know, if you told me that I can't believe in gravity, that's like telling them that you can't believe that that Mars influences war. It was just assumed, like, of course this is true. There were those who disagreed, but it was dominant as a science in their day. Maimonides famously said in the 12th century that you're not allowed to believe in astrology, it's all a myth. But really, even in his day, he was the minority, and he's later than Talmudic times. But that's one approach, is that this is false and it's a gateway to idolatry, therefore you aren't allowed to do it. Another approach to why we're not supposed to be superstitious is in source number 11. Rabbi Moses Nachmanides, 13th century Spain, says, because the more you engage in trying to predict the future, the less you focus on God. He says that there's a biblical verse, you shall be complete with Hashem your God. So he says, what does that mean? We are to dedicate our hearts to God alone and trust that God alone engineers all and knows the truth of all future events. And from God alone, we should seek the future from his prophets or his pious ones, meaning the Urim B'Tumim. What are the Urim B'Tumim? You know what he's referring to? Right, the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, the high priest in the temple, has a breastplate with gems on it representing each of the tribes. And as described in Tanakh, he's the one that the Jews would often approach when they had a question that needed a divine response. That's how we work, not with omens and superstitions. You know, another approach in source number 12, similarly, Rabbi Ovadia Sforno, moving a little bit forward in Jewish history, that you should not trust the words of the time analyzers, meaning people who pick particular times of day as propitious for certain activities. Don't trust the sorcerers. As the sages said, there is no mazal for Israel. Meaning, mazal, not meaning luck, but mazal, the zodiac, astrology, doesn't control our fate. God controls our fate. Not, he isn't saying Jews have no mazel.
Most of the synagogues in the Galil had a zodiac in the synagogues.
Yep.
Which is unbelievable.
So it's only unbelievable if you view it the way that we have come to view astrology. Meaning, what you're saying is, if you look at the mosaics they've discovered in synagogue going back to 2nd century, 3rd century, Caesarea, I think, has it. Yeah. So you will find that they had zodiacs there in the floor, on the wall, in the synagogue, and you're right, it looks strange. Yeah?
In Poland,
this I can't answer for. Pathetic, I don't know.
In Poland, the old synagogues, we went through many.
Yeah.
They all have the zodiac.
Right. Because it wasn't viewed as something that was against Judaism. It was just viewed as, this is the cycle of the stars, and they have whatever influences God has assigned to them. That was the way it was looked at. Whatever force they have is what God embedded in them, in the same way that God embedded forces in everything. That was the way they looked at it.
It doesn't say that it's not true. It just says not true.
So that's the debate. Maimonides says it's false. Others say that it's true, and just you're not supposed to take advantage of future reading. Right. That's true. There were other hands. I saw. Okay. So what we have so far, because I realize I've ducked into a few tangents along the way. The less sleep I get at night, the more the tangents. But the basic point that we've arrived at here is that there are many reasons why we use the apple in terms of picking an apple in particular. The most basic being the sweetness of the apple. And then from there, developing the idea that there are other reasons for apple use, imagery in Tanakh, stories in particular from our history, mysticism. We have other reasons to use it. Fundamentally, there seems to be an attempt to influence what the year is going to be like. Going back to Abaye's statement that signs have meaning. Right? That signs are substantive. That there's an effect to them. It sounds like it's more than just psychology. And I have a problem because I have a biblical prohibition against reading omens and trying to predict the future. I'm supposed to either because the omens don't work, they're false, or because that sabotages my reliance on God. So what are we doing with these apples? And I think that the answer to this is really important in terms of understanding what we're supposed to experience on Rosh Hashanah night when we have the apples or we have the kubba or we have the sheep's head or whatever else it is. So there are three different approaches that I have seen to this. My favorite is the third, but you have to go through one and two first. The first approach is to say that the reason why it is okay to use these is because they fundamentally don't affect what we do. It's not as though I'm going to change what I do this year because I did or did not have an apple and honey on Rosh Hashanah night. If something were to happen and I wasn't able to have an apple and honey on Rosh Hashanah night, it's not as though I would now act differently in the coming year. What the Torah doesn't want me to do is to rely on this. You know, to say, well, I'm not going to get off at the 13th floor, right? Or I'm going to build my building without a 13th floor, right? When you start acting on these things, that's when it gets scary in Judaism. Yeah, you want to feel good because you went outside and you saw something that made you happy, or you ate some food that gave you a good sense, this is going to be a good day, that's fine. But don't act on it. That's your first approach. So that is actually found, the basis for that is a story in the Torah involving what sure looks like someone setting up an omen, and that's the story of Eliezer. Eliezer is the servant of Abraham. After Sarah has died, Abraham realizes he has to find a wife for his son Yitzchak, for his son Isaac. However, Isaac is not supposed to leave the land of Israel. Not allowed to leave. So what is he going to do? So he has to, you know, mail order. No, he has to go find a bride, and he can't take a local girl because the daughters of Canaan are all involved in idolatry. They're all involved in stuff that Abraham does not want being brought into the family. And so he says, let me go get someone from the family in another branch of the family living off to the east in Aram. Okay, go send it back to the family there. He has cousins there. Let's go find someone within the family. We trust that she'll be okay. And he sends Eliezer off with a statement of, go find somebody from the family. Well, take a look at source number 13. Eliezer goes off to the well. He goes to Aram. He shows up at the well, and he utters a prayer. And Eliezer said, God, master of my master Abraham, prepare before me today, perform kindness with my master Abraham. Behold, I will stand at the well of water, and the daughters of the citizens will come to draw water. The girl to whom I will say, please incline your pitcher and I will drink, and she will say, drink and I will also give to your camels to drink. She is the one you have shown for your servant Isaac, and thus I will know that you have performed kindness with my master. So I'm going to know it's the right one if we follow this script. If I ask her for some water and she offers water for me and for my camels. That wasn't his job. His job was not to find a nice girl who's going to offer water for him and for the camels. His job was find his cousin. Right? That was what he was supposed to do. But he creates a script which is in fact branded in the Talmud in source number 14 as a form of reading omens. That's for sure what it sounds like. Right? Any omen reading, which is not like that of Eliezer, the servant of Abraham, and Jonathan, the son of Saul, which is another story, is not forbidden as omen reading. In other words, the forbidden kind is what he did. Well, how am I supposed to understand that? Eliezer is supposed to be righteous. How could he have done that? So the commentators suggest the answer is because he didn't act on it. If you look at sentence 15, after she gives him the water, as she's giving water to the camels, the verse says, and the man, Eliezer, waited mutely for her, silent, to know whether God had made him successful or not. In other words, he wasn't saying the omen worked. Now I know, and therefore she's the right one, and therefore I'm going to ask her to marry my master's son, sight unseen. He wants to wait until he knows that in fact this is correct, that she in fact is the cousin. So the point that you get in this story is, if you don't act on it, then it's okay. You see a good sign, it makes you feel good, that's all right. Similarly, on Rosh Hashanah, it's not as though I eat the apples or the kubbah or the black-eyed peas or whatever it is, and then I say, well, that's good, I don't need to go to synagogue tomorrow. Right? I did it, I took care of it, I don't need to repent, I don't need to pray, I don't need to give tzedakah, because I had sweet foods, Rosh Hashanah night. If someone were to do that, then I would say, yeah, now you're in violation of relying on omens. But if you don't rely on it, it's not a big deal. That's one approach. A second approach is to say, even though the language that we saw back in source number 2 said that signs are substantive, all it really is about is psychology. It's really just about having a sweet year. That's all it is, beginning to end.
And if you take a pear, it's okay.
And if you take a pear, it's okay. Correct. If you just have a pear, it doesn't have to be an apple. Whatever it is that's going to give you a good feeling for the coming year. And there's a reason to say that. Take a look at source number 17. This is fascinating. 17 is another passage from the Talmud. It sounds an awful lot like source number 2, but there's one word that's different. Abaye said, since we say that signs are substantive, one should accustom himself to see gourds and fenugreek, leek, beets, and dates at the start of the year. What's the difference between source number 17 and source number 2? Right. See. In source number 2, it says eat. Another tradition in source number 17 says you just have to see the food. That's all you need. It's the power of sight. And sight, remember, within the Torah, is a very powerful thing. Sight connotes not simply you took in that there's something there. It connotes clarity. Divine perception, right? In the very beginning of the Torah, Vayara Elokim, and God saw that it was good. It's that kind of a clear comprehension. And when Moses speaks to the Jews and he wants them to understand something, he says, Re'eh, I want you to see. It's all about sight. It's making an impact on you. So that's a second approach. It's to say it's just psychology. Yeah.
It's exactly like in Pesach when you're looking at the car, or you say Pesach Matzah.
Oh yeah.
You don't have to eat it, but you.
We use the visual all year long, right? So much of what we do in our rituals is about visualization. Right? The sukkah, right? It's not enough that I say God protected us on our way from Egypt into Israel. I'm going to build a hut. Right? What's that? It's sight. It's also experience overall. There's a lot to be said about differentiated education and how we learn with these different modes. But sight is what impacts on our psyche. So we have one approach that says, yes, these are omens for a good year, but we're not going to act on them. You have another approach that says it's not an omen. It's just meant to put you in a good frame of mind, and you don't even need to eat the fruit. You can just see the fruit. You don't like apples? Just look at them. That's good enough.
Think good and it'll be good.
Yeah, basically. Think good and it'll be good.
These are really, wow, it's just a custom. It's not like a harsh hunting.
So it is absolutely true, right? Gloria says, this is a minhag, this is a custom. And it's not a custom that you would view as having the force of law. There are customs that actually take on the force of law because they're viewed as a vow, like the community has taken a vow, this is what we do. But I think it's generally understood that, you know, if a person doesn't have apples, they don't have apples, and that's it, that's life. But there's a third way to look at it. And this third way, I think, is a very powerful understanding of what it is that we're doing. It goes a little bit back to what Nanette said about it viewing it as a prayer, viewing it as asking for something. A little bit similar to that. We have a principle in the Torah called in Hebrew Maasei Avot Siman Labanim. The deeds of ancestors are a sign for their descendants. And the way it's usually applied is that if you look at the events in the Torah that happened to Abraham and Sarah and their family, many of them replay in the lives of their grandchildren. Most obvious example, after Abraham and Sarah arrive in the land, Lech Lecha, they're told to go, they arrive in the land of Canaan, they start to travel, and then there is a famine and they descend to Egypt. Which, of course, is what happens then for their grandchildren. There is a famine and they descend to Egypt. That which happens in earlier generations is going to play out later. So I could look at that and say, that's sort of a George Santayana type of thing. If you don't learn the lessons of history, or even if you do learn the lessons of history, you're still going to repeat it anyway. But take a look at source number 18, where Nachmanides says no. Right? Moses Nachmanides says, you have to know that all of the decrees of heaven become irreversibly enduring once they cease being decrees and become active and visible. In other words, when God issues a decree that something is going to happen, and it enters into reality, it starts to be implemented, it's no longer just a decree, but it starts to become real. It becomes manifest. And therefore, God had Abraham begin to take control of the land of Israel, and he made Abraham model all that would happen with his descendants. It's bringing it into reality. You find that in Tanakh with many of the prophets, where they are told to carry out something which represents their prophecy in reality. So, for example, the prophet Elisha has a king shoot arrows as a sign that the king is going to shoot arrows in victory in a war against another nation. So he says, I want you to go out and actually fire arrows. You are bringing the decree that you are going to go to war and succeed into reality by beginning to fire these arrows. Or Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah, has a scribe who works for him named Baruch. And he tells Baruch, there's a vision that Babylon is going to sink. I want you to take a scroll, tie a stone to it, and throw it into the river where it will sink to demonstrate Babylon sinking. Not just as a visual to carry a message, but to actually begin to convert this vision into reality. You start to actually make it happen. We are taught that in general, good decrees are not reversed in source number 19. That good decree, when God says something good is going to happen, it always will happen. But we're helping it along by bringing it into reality, and therefore it's not a problem of superstition, because what you're actually doing, according to this school of thought, is real. It's not, I'm taking what I hope is God's decree for me to have a good year, and I'm actually making it a good year by creating a good experience for me on and for my family on Rosh Hashanah night. I'm actually starting that good year, making it real. You follow? Take a look at source number 20, Rabbi Yehuda Leib, also known as Maharal.
Sorry, what was the one instance in number 19?
So that instance is based on a passage in the book of Yechezkel, the book of Ezekiel, in which there's a command that God issues that the angel should write a letter Tav, the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet, on the heads of the righteous. That's the decree, is to write a letter Tav on the heads of the righteous, indicating that they're righteous and they're going to be spared from a plague that's coming. However, as the chapter then continues, even that verse continues, the plague actually starts with those righteous people. In other words, they're not spared. And that's what this passage in the Talmud is commenting on, is that story where they were told they were going to be spared, or the decree is made they will be spared, and then they're not spared. And the Talmud asks, well, what happened? And it tells this very fascinating story of a conversation, so to speak, going on up in the heavens, in which God's attribute of justice says, it's true that those people are righteous, but they didn't educate the rest of the population to keep them from sinning. To which God's attribute of mercy says, yeah, but those other people wouldn't have listened to them anyway. To which justice says, you know they wouldn't have listened. I know they wouldn't have listened. But those people don't know that. They don't know that no one would have listened to them. They were responsible to try, and that's why they get punished for not trying to educate the others. That's the one story where a good decree is reversed. What we're trying to do here is to take a good decree and to actually carry it out in some sense. If you look at number 20, Maharal says, he says, now know and understand this, for it is an amazing insight to create for a heavenly decree an emulation and sign below, so that the good will come to pass and the decree will be fulfilled for the good. Therefore, it is fitting to create a sign and emulation as we find the prophets did. This is the matter of emulating in eating or seeing, depending on whether you take source number 2 or source number 17. At the start of the year, items which have a good sign, so that the decree will emerge into reality, and the good decree will thereby be fulfilled. He says, this is not nichush. This is not the problem of superstition. It is only preparation for the fulfillment of the decree for the good. This is what they meant with, quote, since they say that signs are substantive, right, that we saw in the Talmud, for it is substantive in this regard, that via the sign, the decree will emerge into positive reality. That's the idea. You're concretizing the good decree. I find that to be a remarkable idea. I have to admit, I'm a rationalist. Yeah. You know, I like things I can see, things that I can explain. Mm-hmm. But this resonates. The idea for me, you know, your mileage may vary. But for me, the fact that you have this enduring practice, and you're talking about something going back to Talmudic times, a couple of thousand years ago, of eating sweet foods on Rosh Hashanah night, the fact that that has stuck with us in all of our cultures and all the places we have wandered, says to me that it's about more than psychology. It's more than just put yourself in a good frame of mind, because cultures change and psychologies change. And I feel like there was a sense that this was more meaningful than just get yourself into a good mood, but that there was a sense that if we actually take the bull by the horns, so to speak, if we actually will create a good year, that will have an impact on what happens going forward. So what I, you know, as we sit at our table on Wednesday night, the 20th, right, the 20th, and we partake of our apples and our honey, let's focus on these three elements. On earning a sweet year is always important. Don't just rely on the superstitions, okay? Don't just rely on whatever experience this is. Earning a sweet year, like Eliezer is not going to act on the omen. Putting ourselves into an upbeat and optimistic frame of mind, but also making real that hoped-for divine decision that should in fact be a year of blessing. I look forward to seeing everybody here, God willing, next week, when we will discuss water as the second half of this. If, 1 second. Sorry. Again, if you paid me in the beginning and you didn't get a chance to write your name down on this, please see me. I want all the numbers to match up. I wouldn't want to think someone had not paid. Thank you.